Tonight, the traffic cops of Bedfordshire and Hertfordshire come face to face...
Hello, welcome to the third part of Media Futures, the series where the BBC has asked me to look at what might be in store for our established media as they learn to adapt to a digital world. I'm Mark Coles, and a bit of a couch potato this week. Remote control in one hand, TV dinner for one, balanced precariously on my knee.
If you've got stainless steel appliances...
Beautiful dancing girls.
Bloody, bloody, blah.
94 channels, and I still can't find anything I want to watch. Pop Girl, Babe Station, The God Channel, Gay Rabbit. What's all that?
It's the MasterChef final.
That's more like it. You join me this week in my living room, the part of the house which, for as long as I can remember, has been dominated by the box in the corner. The TV's been talking to us for about 80 years now, ever since the BBC made the world's first public broadcast. But as we've heard in earlier parts of this series, the future seems to be about where we talk back to the media, where media will be everywhere, not just on a fixed specific device like a television set. A future where different media will converge to create new user experiences. So how's this all going to affect this box here in the corner? Are its days numbered? Are legacy broadcasters an endangered species? Or will television somehow manage to escape the most disruptive effects of digital? Well, pained as I am to do so, let's turn MasterChef off now and begin by eavesdropping on a vision of TV future in where else? Los Angeles, California.
Bring it on.
My name's Liam Collins. I'm the head of the YouTube Space LA. So we're standing in the lobby. It's a big, open, cavernous space. Our goal was to make it sort of like a cathedral to video.
And action. 2, 3, 4.
The YouTube space is the first facility in the world designed exclusively for the use of channels on YouTube. Anyone who uploads videos on YouTube basically can create a channel. And that's the price of admission to come use this facility.
Great, excellent.
After years of hosting shaky videos of somersaulting singing pet dogs or toddlers called Charlie biting other toddlers' fingers, YouTube is going upmarket. Its parent company, Google, is pouring in money to try to rebrand its output as channels. Not linear broadcast channels as we know them, of course. In fact, anyone can build a YouTube channel, just like the people shooting here. But be warned, because this kind of visual media, previously scorned by some as simple bubblegum to fill spare moments on smartphones, is now set to compete with broadcast television in terms of both its quality and its reach.
All right, so now let's walk back through the lobby. We're headed now into the production areas of the facility. Thank you. Let's duck our heads in here. Hi, guys.
Hello. How's it going?
What are you guys working on today?
We're actually cutting a sizzle for the creative camp.
Sure.
And so we're just kind of compiling the best moments of the past couple of days. And
got it. So we're in one of our edit suites. We have 10 of these edit suites. The idea of these rooms is that it's supposed to be as simple as a flip cam, but it's a place that someone as experienced as Steven Spielberg could come in and find all the tools that they need to do their work. Thanks, guys.
A Steven Spielberg foot cam sizzle. I'd watch that. And I might be able to soon, as more TV sets become internet-enabled. This kind of high-quality web content could soon be finding its way from the computer screen onto the screens of our living room TVs.
There's lots of different screens out there. You can call them television screens or mobile phones or tablets, whatever. But our ambition for our creators and our channels is that they're on every screen. So part of what you see in this facility, we have a screening room that has a theater-style screen to put creators in situations where they can understand how their content plays in a setting like that. And many of them want to be in the living room.
But being in the living room, getting their content on TV screens, emphatically does not mean using online video as a stepping stone to a career in the established TV industry.
So let's do a full rehearsal for camera and for the actors.
We're rehearsing for one of our scenes coming up here, just the actor rehearsal. And we gotta be quiet because they're starting.
My name is Freddie Wong, one of the co-creators of Video Game High School.
I'm Matthew Arnold, the other co-creator of Video Game High School.
Yeah, so what we're doing here is we're shooting the second season of our web series, which we shot first season last year, and this is the second one.
Great, okay, first team stepping on. Okay, guys.
I think a lot of people online, they try and use online video as a stepping stone. You know, it's like, this is my path to a television show, and this is my path to doing a feature film. And for us, like, well, what, why would we want to do
that? Yeah, there's never been any other end game for us. I feel like, especially back, you know, a couple years ago, it was always YouTube to move on to TV or movies. But we feel like the rest of media is running toward the internet.
And we look at online video as like a new form, in the same way that like television was a new form when it came out. And we think going online and putting, you know, videos directly to an audience so that the audience can find it and watch it and communicate with us is the way that media entertainment is going. And it's very exciting to be a part of that.
Online video platforms such as YouTube liberate creators from the rules and regulations of established broadcasting. Programs can be as long or short as you like. They can be accessed whenever a viewer wants. You can get instant feedback from viewers. And since there's an infinite supply of airtime, everyone's welcome to take part. No need to get your work commissioned or approved. In fact, YouTube leaves all the creative and editorial decisions to the video makers themselves, who also keep all the rights to their material. But YouTube denies it's trying to muscle in on the TV industry. If anything, it's inviting the TV industry to join it.
The destruction of your videos has just begun. Destroy.
My name is Daniel Kellison. I am originally a television producer. What I'm doing now is I'm doing two YouTube channels.
So Jash will be making all the videos from now on.
They came to us last year and said, you know, are you interested in doing comedy channels? And really, it was an unbelievable offer, I thought, because they said, we're going to give you complete autonomy. You'll have 100% creative autonomy. You'll never get a note from us. And in the end of all this, you'll own everything 100%. I was like, okay, well, let's do it. I feel like we're on the ground floor of something. It's something brand new. And it's exciting, I think. And sort of cable overtook network TV, and network TV overtook radio, satellite overtook radio. And then I feel like we're in a place now where 2 years from now, television will not resemble anything we know.
How can YouTube do all this? Well, it's partly down to our old friend, the computer algorithm. Google has found a way to discover what we like looking at and talking about online, an invaluable guide to the sort of adverts we might not mind being offered. Indeed, on its web pages, Google has been using it to do just that for years. But now it's applying the same technology to the commercials that run before any YouTube content we watch. YouTube's head of content, Robert Kinsel, is convinced targeted ads like these are about to give linear TV commercials a serious run for their money.
Our ad sales force started to focus on video. And out of that came a format called TrueView, which is a skippable ad format, which pretty much turns advertising upside down. Users only watch ads that they care about. They can skip them after 5 seconds. And if they do, the advertiser only pays for ads which are being watched.
And computer algorithms seem to be working, so much so that YouTube's TrueView is scoring remarkable percentages of people who choose to watch ads in full rather than automatically skipping them after 5 seconds. In some cases, up to almost half of all viewers, which gives YouTube the edge over conventional TV commercials.
I don't drink beer. There's no reason to display Budweiser or Coors commercials to me. Yet I see a lot of those on television. Clearly those impressions are wasted on me. On YouTube, that wouldn't happen because of targeting. YouTube knows that those are ads that I would skip out of. So over time, we learn more and more about each user, and we're targeting different ads to different people, and it automatically adjusts.
The problem for broadcast television isn't only companies like YouTube with their youthful audiences, consumer-friendly ads, and short-form content that lends itself to phones and computers. It's also about so-called time-shifted content. The more we record our favourite programmes and watch them later, the less likely we are to watch the real-time commercials that TV depends on to survive. We just zap through them. Some channels now report up to half of all content is viewed time-shifted. Meanwhile, so-called over-the-top services are also offering content streamed from the internet, independent of the main broadcast channels, and available on any device you want. Services like Netflix, the online film channel, which is now said to account for a quarter of the entire bandwidth used across the United States. But does all this really mean that TV, as we know it, is in danger?
Clearly in the future, it's going to make no difference whether this fantastic show that you're watching is delivered over your TV aerial or over the internet, and whether it's broadcast to other people at the same time or you watching it when you want.
This is Anthony Rose, inventor of the BBC iPlayer, which streams BBC TV programmes over the web. He's now pioneering another clever device, which could herald a different future for television, one where television actually survives.
I see an evolution of TV where the TV itself is a beautiful, high-definition, thin, glossy panel that just plays out the programme, and the means of selecting the program to watch is now done on your iPhone or tablet or something like that. And when you click play, your smartphone tells your TV to play that.
Rose's new gadget is called ZBox. It's a smartphone app that will, he says, enhance television rather than replacing it. It operates on several levels. First, as a guide to what's available across the huge range of information sources we can now choose from. Then, the idea is you keep that smartphone or tablet handy as a so-called second screen while you're viewing the main one. It could even act as the remote controller. And the really clever bit, through the ZBox app, you can then also chat to friends on social media about what you're watching, send tweets and get sidebar information about the content on the main screen. Clearly, this second screen idea is going to work best when we're watching live TV, big events like sport or talent shows, which might just be the shot in the arm traditional broadcast TV needs, because if we're watching live, we'll be more likely to watch the adverts it depends on.
Increasingly, broadcasters are looking to take advantage of second screen to drive more live viewing and to get people to engage in new ways. And so the engagements could be as simple as the game show. We always watch game shows and we love to guess the answers ourselves. But wouldn't it be great if when you guess the answer, it could be projected back onto the TV? Could you have a leaderboard? And if you guess the answers better than anyone else, your name appears. And so programs are beginning to evolve.
Xbox, your interactive episodes. Next. Super Maria. Play now.
What about interacting with the actual content we're watching? Changing it according to what we say or do? Just down the road from ZBox HQ in London's West End, there's another TV revolution underway.
Sesame Street is an educational show for kids. It contains puppets that they call Muppets, which live on this street called Sesame Street, which is a fictional street in New York. And you have characters like Elmo and Cookie Monster and Big Bird and the Count, and they help the kids learn in an amazingly fun way.
Sesame Street is a show that's been loved by children for over 40 years. Even I remember it from my youth. But under the direction of Rob Stevens and his colleagues at London's Soho Productions, Sesame Street's got a whole new look and feel.
I love pretending. Say hey! Why don't you pretend with me? Yeah, it's better when we play together.
Welcome to TV that the viewer, in this case a young child, can, by using the Microsoft Xbox, actually appear in and interact with the characters on screen.
Xbox 360 is Microsoft's console. It was traditionally a games console released a few years ago, but really what we've realised is over the years it's evolved from becoming a bedroom gaming console through to becoming more of a media set-top box that sits underneath the TV in the living room. And people are really much more than they ever have done in the past. They've been using it to consume media content.
The Xbox enables TV to point the camera back at the viewer. In this case, it's a special camera that can detect movement. Software then incorporates the actions of the audience into the story unfolding on screen. It's just one example of how our media are converging with each other. Just as newspapers are no longer newspapers since they've gone online and started to include audio and video, so television is also merging with other types of communication. In this case, the relatively new sphere of computer gaming, allowing us to break out of our armchair slumbers and actually get involved in what we're watching.
It really is this fusion of traditional linear content and the kind of mechanics and structures that we come to expect from modern video games. So at the point where the characters break the fourth wall and ask you to join in, you really can join in. You can play catch with Elmo, you can jump along with Cookie Monster, you can sing along to a music video. This is an example of one of our what we call original interactive videos.
Dom de dom. Oh, hiya. Me got hungry in middle of bath. Yeah, so me decide to run out for some biscotti.
So Cookie Monster is going out for biscotti. He's dropped his soap, and Grover is coming through delivering coconuts. Let's see what happens. Oh, so Grover's fallen over. He's dropped all of his coconuts in my living room.
I seem to have spilled all of my coconuts.
So I've got to help him find all of his coconuts. So if I pick one up here and throw an imaginary coconut.
Thank you.
The coconut's flown in. He's caught it and he's thanked me for it and he's counted the coconut. Great catch.
You know, once upon a time there was black and white, and then there was color, and then there was 3D, and there was HD. But in all of those models, essentially someone's shooting the same content and then broadcasting it to millions of people. You couldn't interact with it. It's one way, unidirectional. But does it have to be that way?
Anthony Rose again.
Imagine you watching this fantastic David Attenborough program on wildlife, on polar bears. And instead of merely watching it, could you be sitting with your smartphone on Google Maps trying to identify the polar bears yourself and telling them where to go? Could millions of people be collaborating around a show to make the shows interactive?
I think what we're seeing across all types of media is this blurring of the lines between what we've traditionally come to understand is television or is games or is web content or app content. And that's just becoming much more widespread. There are very few screens that are handheld nowadays that you can't touch and affect in some way. And I think interactive TV is a really great example of that.
Throughout this series, we've seen how obsessed the media world's become with interactivity. So it's hardly surprising that television's also moving in this direction. If Sesame Street and its ilk are successful, there'll surely be more. And kids growing up on this kind of fare will, as adults, expect to interact with content. Even those of us who don't want to will soon notice the difference as programmes change to accommodate interactivity.
One of the conscious decisions that we made when we were designing this up front was that we needed something that had a slightly different meter, had a slightly different pace, was snappier to interact with. So all of our chapters, rather than being 20 minutes long or 15 minutes long, they're all 2 minutes long, 3 minutes long, 4 minutes long. So if kids get tired and they sit down for a little bit, they've got a point no more than 5 minutes away where they have another opportunity to jump in and out.
The revolution in television has been a long time coming, and it could still be a while yet before it's fully realised. According to one recent piece of market research, globally, less than a third of us have any interest in interacting with TV programmes. It concluded that the saturated media markets of the West are less likely than developing countries like India and China to fully utilise so-called smart TV sets. Not that this worries Anthony Rose. As he points out, passive viewing is itself an artificial phenomenon with no automatic right to a future.
Once upon a time, people sat around a campfire and told each other stories. The graphics were terrible, you had to imagine it, but it was fully interactive. And then cinemas came and we all got together in a cinema and spoke about it after the cinema, but we couldn't talk about it while the movie was on. And then television came along and we all watched together separately at home. But why does it have to be that way?
But others are scathing about TV's attempt to catch up with new technology. Back at the YouTube space in LA, Freddie and Matt believe it's time to accept that the big broadcasters and their big boxes in the living room are the dinosaurs of the media landscape and about to become extinct.
people, especially the younger crowd, the younger generation, are spending more time on their phones. And it's funny because it's the same argument that happened when television first came out.
Yeah, right? They've been watching on a small screen.
Yeah, there's no point. And then, in fact, what happened was cinema invented widescreen. Television was so successful with that small screen that cinema had to invent technology.
And now we have 3D. And now TV needs to have web series, or needs to have live Twitter feeds, or needs all these other gimmicks to essentially compete with what is more and more becoming the new media.
Exactly.
You know, in science, there's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. The act of measuring something changes the measurement itself. And so I think the act of saying the death of television spurs broadcasters to act.
Anthony Rose, one last time, with a reminder that television remains a lucrative, highly resourceful industry, one that's unlikely to stand idle or roll over and die when threatened by newcomers. So whatever the future for TV, don't write it off just yet.
Broadcasters are not stupid. They see a world today which is driven by live viewing, and as they read more about video on demand shifts and so on, they react by intentionally creating content designed to be viewed live and investing in second screen companies and technologies and propositions designed to encourage live viewing. So it'll be interesting to see, with the trend to unlimited channel availability, how will a broadcaster react? They've got the budget, they've got the content, they've got the people who know content. They're smart people, and I think the fascinating new propositions will evolve to help the broadcaster maintain a dominance in this shifting new space.
Tonight at 10, the Queen marks 60 years since the coronation at Westminster Abbey. The UN says the war in Syria has...
So, the situation so far. Newspapers slaughtered by online. As Programme 1 showed, they were the first to get caught out big time by digital. Programme 2 showed us that radio is the sort of broadcasting equivalent of a cockroach surviving a nuclear holocaust. Its simplicity means it's less affected by upheaval or radical change. And TV, well, it's the last of the big three legacy media to face the challenge of online and social media. But as this programme has demonstrated, it's now being forced to. Although the notice period it's enjoyed so far might mean it has a chance of adapting and surviving on its own terms. Whatever happens, back here in my front room, I think I'm just about prepared. I've got my old-style TV. Video Game High School is running on YouTube, while the six-year-old is busy introducing himself to Sesame Street. The future of TV probably lies more with him than me. I've already witnessed the great leap forward from black and white to colour, from analogue to digital and now online, from 3 to 300 channels. All of that in just 50 years. Well, it's his turn now. His turn to dream, to interact and to hang on tightly as we fast forward into the future. Next week, in our final programme, what wider conclusions can we draw from my journey into the future of media? Join me then.